I'd like to welcome you tonight and greet you in Jesus' name. I wonder if your chairs are as comfortable as Brother Allen's are. He's inviting me to talk for a long time, and I told somebody earlier that I am tired of sitting already. I'm glad I get to stand tonight. And, anyway, we'll leave that alone. But I'm happy to be with you here tonight, and I hope you're not expecting some life-changing revelation tonight in what we're going to share. To me, as I considered this subject tonight and as I thought about what we're going to share, it's really some pretty simple, small things. And it really centers around Christ and what he would have for us. I would like to take this opportunity to give a thank you to the local congregation here for hosting these meetings and for your good work in taking care of us. I'm also thankful for the privilege of coming to the meetings. We heard this afternoon about bench warmers. And you know, as I sat and listened to that, there's something in me that I sense in my own heart a type of a bench warmer right here. And it was good to hear that. And it's been inspiring to be here this weekend. Two things that stood out to me. Especially many others, but two of them I'm going to mention. One is the beginning message that focused on the sovereignty of God and the free will of man. I just reflect back on that and the privilege of serving a sovereign God. I'm just thankful for that. And the fact that that sovereign God has given each man the choice, the power to exercise a will. That is beyond my understanding, but it is a wonderful mystery, and it's only a God like our God that could put that together. And I was thankful for that. And then, as I mentioned already, I was challenged with the message on bench warmers, and I was so glad that Brother Johnny spoke about the bench warmers within, because, well, there was some practical meat for me there. I would like to invite you to two passages tonight, Luke chapter 5 and John chapter 21. And while we are going there, the title that we have this evening is Cast Your Net. Cast Your Nets on the Other Side. And I just had an interesting question. Where does that title come from? Any ideas? I like participation from the audience, so I'm going to give you that opportunity. Where does the title come from, Cast Your Nets on the Other Side? Without asking the brethren who assigned it. Thank you. From the song, Peter, James, and John had a little sailboat. And the term cast your net on the other side. Now, I will admit to you that I expected to find that phrase in the Bible. And I went looking for it, and it is not in my Bible. I don't know, maybe it's in yours, but it's not in my Bible. Cast Your Nets on the Other Side. That doesn't make it a bad title, and I'm not making fun. It's just that I'm admitting to you that I went looking for it and didn't find it. but let's go anyway to these two passages, to these two stories. Very beautiful stories. I'm going to start with Luke chapter 5. And I want you to see the picture here. I want you to put yourself in the picture of the story, or in the story that happens here. We're going to read from verse 1 of Luke chapter 5. And it came to pass that as the people pressed upon him to hear the word of God, he stood by the lake of Gennesaret and saw two ships standing by the lake, but the fishermen were gone out of them and were washing their nets. And he entered into one of the ships, which was Simon's, and prayed him that he would thrust out a little from the land. And he sat down and taught the people out of the ship. Now when he left speaking, he said unto Simon, Launch out into the deep, and let down your nets for a draught. And Simon answering said unto him, Master, we have toiled all the night, and have taken nothing. Nevertheless, at thy word I will let down the net. And when they had this done, they enclosed a great multitude of fishes, and their net brake. And they beckoned unto their partners, which were in the other ship, and that they should come and help them. And they came and filled both the ships so that they began to sink. When Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." For he was astonished, and all they that were with him, at the draught of fishes that they had taken. And so was also James and John, the sons of Zebedee, which were partners with Simon. And Jesus said unto Simon, "Fear not, from henceforth thou shalt catch men." And when they had brought their ships to land, they forsook all and followed him. That's good for us to just put ourselves into the story that we find here. So here we have Jesus standing on the shore of the lake. And there were so many people around him. They were pressing around him to hear him teach about God. And Jesus saw two ships behind him. And the fishermen were there washing their nets. And he asked Simon, one of the fishermen, to get the boat. Jesus sat in the boat, and Simon rowed out just a little bit. And he sat in the boat and spoke to the people. Now, we're not used to that many people being crowded around. If you go to some other countries, like if you've been in Bangladesh, you'll understand this story a little better and see the amount of people gathered around. Not just Bangladesh, but a country like that. But as I considered this, what impressed me was Simon sitting in the boat, listening to Jesus. Have you ever sat at a place close by when somebody's teaching and you just had the privilege of sitting there and listening? A little like the children did this afternoon with Malin. Or maybe, sometimes I experience that. It's a little different experience when you sit up here behind the pulpit when somebody else is teaching. You're just kind of sitting there behind them, listening to what they're having to say. And that's the picture I have of Simon here, as he's just sitting there listening to Jesus. And when Jesus gets done, he turns around to Simon and says, "Simon, take this boat out where it's deep and throw in your net to catch fish." And Simon's response was, "Lord, we spent the whole night fishing." Simon was a good fisherman. He knew when to fish, he knew where to fish, and he knew how to take care of his nets. "We've done all that, Lord, and we have caught nothing. It's really not a good time to fish. It's really not a good place to fish." Maybe it was sometime, but it wasn't last night. "But I want you to catch his next words. Nevertheless, at thy words, we'll cast the net." And the rest of the story is they caught so many that their net began to break. And they almost sank two boats with the catch of fishes. Now, let's turn to John chapter 21 before we talk about that more. I wondered at first if these are the same story, but I don't think so, because the timing is too diverse. Sometimes in the Gospels, I don't think everything is in chronology, so sometimes you have two stories that seem to be the same, and they seem to fit in a different setting. But the other one Jesus was teaching, this one is after Jesus died and rose again. And in John chapter 21, I'd like to read again from verse 1. "After these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, and on this wise showed he himself. There were together Simon Peter and Thomas called Didymus, and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee, and two other of his disciples. Simon Peter saith unto them, 'I go fishing.' They say unto him, 'We also go with thee.' They went forth and entered into a ship immediately, and that night they caught nothing. But when morning was now come, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples knew not that it was Jesus. Then Jesus saith unto them, 'Children, have ye any meat?' They answered him, 'No.' And he said unto them, 'Cast the net on the right side of the ship, and ye shall find.' They cast therefore, and now they were not able to draw it for the multitude of fishes. Therefore that disciple whom Jesus loved saith unto Peter, 'It is the Lord.' Now when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he girt his fisher's coat unto him, for he was naked, and had cast himself into the sea. And the other disciples came in a little ship, for they were not far from land. but as it were 200 cubits, dragging the net with fishes. As soon as they were come to land, they saw a fire of coals there, and fish laid thereon, and bread. Jesus saith unto them, Bring of the fish which ye have now caught. Simon Peter went up and drew the net to land, full of great fishes, 153. For all there were so many, yet was not the net broken. Jesus saith unto them, Come and dine. And none of the disciples durst ask him, Who art thou? Knowing that it was the Lord's. So another beautiful story of not catching anything, and Jesus telling them to cast their nets. Now, I want you to understand several things as we begin talking here tonight. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about these stories, and I'm going to talk about the work that we would like to work, or we would like to work under God in the country of Bangladesh. But as we look at this, there's a couple of misconceptions that you could have tonight, that I could have. And I don't want you to have those, and I don't intend to have it. So I'm going to be out with it real quick. We can have the idea that we have been doing mission work the wrong way. So now we are going to, instead of having our net on one side of the boat, we're going to go across and throw it in on the other side of the boat, and we're going to do it different, and it's going to work out better. I just want to dispel your any possibility that that's what the title means or that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Because that's not my intent. I do not feel that way about past mission endeavors. We've made a lot of mistakes in life. We can all say that. It is but by the grace of God that any good comes. But neither do we need to look at the past and pick it all apart. That's not what this is about tonight. So I want to be very clear with that. I also want to say that we can get hung up on let's do it this way or that way. And mission work, by nature of what it is, there are always discussions of shall we do it by, you name them, colonization, or shall we do it by this way, or shall we do it by that way? And what inspired my heart as I considered these stories were Jesus gave specific direction, but in both of these stories, what was the answer to the catch? A fish. Obedience to the word of Christ. You know, I read one time, it really made me sad to read this. I read this in I think I still have the book on my bookshelf. It was a Bible dictionary or something, customs and something about customs of the Bible. And it told about John 21, and it explained it that maybe as Jesus stood on the shore, he could see where the school of fish was, and so he told them where to cast the nets, and that way they got the catch. I didn't like that, and I don't like that. There are circumstances that you can put something, you know, that's true sometimes, right? But as you look at the story and as you put yourself where these men were in the stories, do you remember what Peter says at the end of the first in Luke 5? He said, Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, when he saw the miracle of the fishes. And in the second account, in John 21, they didn't ask anymore, Is it the Lord's? They knew it was the Lord's. And what I want to say tonight is we consider reaching out and doing the work of God. There is a point to considering how we do things. I'm not just about do it anyway, but I think sometimes we spend too much time arguing about how we're going to do it and not just obeying the command to put the net in the water. Now, Jesus did say, and I think that's where we get the idea of the other side of the boat, is he said, put it on the right side. And I suppose you could take that and say, put it on the right side, Jesus tells you to. I'm assuming there's something to do with the right side as how they threw the net. I did not research some of that. It would be very interesting. There may be something there. But what I really want to emphasize is that in obeying Christ, they recognized in both accounts, they recognized as a miracle that Jesus accomplished. Isn't it a miracle when we, as sinners, obey Jesus? When we choose to follow him through the new birth, like we heard last night? Isn't it a miracle when someone else looks on and says, I'm a sinner, I want to follow him too? Isn't that a miracle? Isn't it a miracle that we're given the privilege of, as Jesus said to Peter, from now on you will catch men? Isn't it a miracle? Shouldn't it always be a miracle? Should we say that it's the way we're doing mission work that is doing it so well? Should we really say those kind of things? I wonder. I wonder about that. What does it mean? Or what kind of application can we make to the overnight toil and no fish? Is there any application for you and I? And I ask myself the question, in my relating to people around me, in my work, where I'm at in life, do I care that other people know about Jesus? Is my toil an overnight toil of doing my own thing? Do you understand the picture that you can see here of Peter and the disciples in both stories, especially found in John 21? They were disappointed. Jesus had died. Their hopes of a kingdom established, their hopes of something great were gone. And Peter went back to doing what he knew. I go fishing. Could we make an application? Should we make an application in our own lives of a lack of vision? At least at times, a lack of vision. Should we make that kind of application? Does God speak that application to you and I? What about a lack of direction or guidance? Can you see anything there in the story as you consider that picture of toiling all night? You know, one thing I do want to say in this, and that is that as you look at these stories, Jesus never condemned them for their overnight toil, did he? He just gave them instructions to follow his instructions. But I think there is an application there for us to think about in our toiling. What I do want to come to, though, is very strongly, I believe this is the key to these two stories in the passage, is Peter's words, nevertheless at thy words, I will let in the nets. Nevertheless at thy words. And so I want to reemphasize this, but this is not a thing of, okay, we've tried it this way, we've been skunked, we do not see results, and so now we're going to do it different. I would like us to be very clear that if we're going to pursue something, we want to do it in this framework. Nevertheless, at thy words, we'll cast in the net. Nevertheless, at thy words. And to recognize the miracle of the catch. As these men experienced it, and as we are called to labor, the miracle is God's, not ours. You know, in life, as we think about toiling all night and as we think about Jesus' instruction, in life and in especially in sharing the gospel and in reaching out to others, I want you to understand that resistance does not equal failure. And resistance does not mean you should stop. Have you observed those who have reached others for Christ? Can you recount one of them that has not faced resistance? I can give you stories. And you probably can give other stories. There are stories of men who spent nights in prison, in jail. There are stories of people who were killed in travel. And some people took that as, are you sure you should be doing this? Shouldn't you just stay home? There are stories of family members who've died. Is resistance to reaching others for Christ, is that a good enough reason to stop? What it does is it tests our vision and it tests our reliance on God for direction. I want to give you some. I listened recently to the story of Adoniram Judson, the first missionary that was sent from the U.S., from the country of U.S. He went to Burma. It's a very, very interesting story. And yes, one thing that I was impressed with in that story, this was the biography by, and I don't remember the man's name, but I remember the Janet Bang, Bangay. But one of the things that I was impressed with is the times of discouragement. There were times when he actually wondered, am I doing what I should be doing? There were times as they went, and their travel was not like ours is today. And there were times when other people said, don't cast your life away, don't go there. And yet they felt a calling of God to go there, and they made a choice to go. And what I sense in that is that God was directing the whole time. And some of those choices could have went one way or another. But the vision and the zeal and the following God's, through a lifetime of following God, did bring the gospel to people. And I think sometimes we get hung up, we're looking for some major revelation that this is what we should do right now. Or this is the country we should go to. Or that is how we should do it. Maybe we should just go through the doors that open and continue to go through the doors that open. And when resistance comes, maybe it's time for us to ask God, is this where you want us? Do you have a message in this? Do we continue? And then realize that resistance is not an equation, does not equal failure, or does not always mean you should stop. Often doesn't. And discouragement comes to all. Those things are just the way it will be. I would like to think, as we think of these two stories, I would like to think of two commands of Christ. As we're thinking of Jesus saying, cast the net in the waters, I'd like to think of two commands. The first one is found in Matthew chapter 9. Verses 36-38. And when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion on them because they fainted and were scattered abroad as sheep having no shepherds. Then said he unto his disciples, the harvest truly is plenteous, but the laborers are few. Go and find lots of people to go into the harvest. That's not what it says. Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest that he will send forth laborers into his harvest. One thing that we are called to pray is that God would send laborers into his harvest. I think there's a going and there's a calling and there are the things to tell to ask others to go. But here is an instruction of Christ. Pray the Lord of the harvest that he would send forth laborers into the harvest. We had the other instruction read tonight. We thought about it in the devotional. The Great Commission, where Jesus says, go and teach all nations. And also noticing the power there that Christ promised. Now, as we think of those commands, they aren't huge, are they? You and I can both do both of them. You don't have to wait for a mission board to come knock on your door to do either of these. We can spend time asking God to send forth laborers into the harvest. We can tell others about Christ. We can teach them about Jesus. You don't have to wait on somebody else. And yet, as I thought about that, how seriously do we take that? I see it as an instruction to drop the net into the water. It's a command that Jesus said we should do this. And I have to look at myself. How much time do I spend praying that God would send forth laborers into his harvest? It's a work of God's. And there's something in that, I think, that prepares our hearts too. All right, I want to focus a little bit yet on the miracle and the work of God's. I repeat, as I said earlier, as these disciples saw this, they said, it is the Lord. It's the Lord. And Simon said, Lord, depart from me, for I am a sinful man. Now, obviously, his first response was, I'm so needy. I'm here in the presence of one who is God, who has God's power, who is God's, if you will. And his first response was, I'm a sinful man. Just like Isaiah, when he saw the holiness of God, he said the same kind of thing. And I think that's so important for us in this subject, is to see the Lord in the miraculous that he accomplishes. I want to give a few notes of miracle that I ran across. Again, I'm going to use Adoniram Judson's story. One of the things that Adoniram Judson did that is so interesting to me, and we ran across this a little bit in Bangladesh. Now, Burma, Myanmar, is down at the bottom end of Bangladesh, and Bangladesh was a part of India. And so in translating the scriptures, for the Bengalis, for the people of Bangladesh and that part of India, they have the Bible that William Carey translated. And for the people in Burma or Myanmar, Adoniram Judson is the one who translated that. Now, in the time that Adoniram was in Burma, Britain went to war with Burma. And all of the foreigners were put in prison. And Adoniram had just finished the New Testament, a tremendous amount of work in translation. And he was anxious over what would happen to this translation. And so he and his wife talked about it. He was in prison, and he told her to sew it into the ugliest pillow, the worst material, something that nobody would want, and bring it to him in prison, and he would lay his head on it, and that way it would stay safe. And one day, as the guards took him from one place to another, and the guard made him leave the pillow behind. And as far as he knew, it was gone. Now, he spent over a year in prison. And shortly after he got out, one of the believers in the country met with him. And what had happened was, he had come there to the prison the day or several days after Adoniram had been moved. And the guards had taken this ugly old pillow and thrown it out in the garbage heap. And he had come there looking for some memento of his friend, and so he took it home. And he's going to wash it, but he's recognized something's odd about this thing, and he ripped it open, and here are the manuscripts. And so he saved them. Now, I don't know how you could look at that without seeing a miracle. God preserved his word. It's a beautiful example of that. His word in the language of the people and for their benefit. But you know, Adoniram tried to do what he could to save that manuscript. But he was powerless. He really couldn't do it, could he? But God didn't need him to. And I don't know, I just think we need a re-inspiration, a re-understanding that we are not so important. Our obedience is important. That prison story, you know, that is the beautiful story too. That whole story is a beautiful story. How God used the combination of Adoniram and his wife. His wife actually, by the friends she made, helped him stay in the country of Burma. It wasn't just Adoniram himself. It was God used the combination. And her ministry to him almost seemed like it kept him alive in prison. Her ministry to those that were there in prison. But they suffered much there. I think he spent most of the year, every night, they would take these men and they would chain their legs up to a center pole and suspend them. From that pole, they still were resting on their shoulders so they could not get away. For almost a year, he spent sleeping nights that way. And the mosquitoes in some of those places were bad. So they couldn't do anything about it. They had to suffer it. And we have no fraction of an idea of the cost of what it took even to travel there. I thought about that. We traveled to Bangladesh in a nice 777. I thought it was pretty bad to sit in that seat for 14 hours, but we have no idea of the cost. So, as we conclude looking at these stories, I just want to emphasize again, the work is God's. I think we can rest in that. The obedience is ours. And I'm challenged by that. And, yes. So I'd like to talk a little bit about Bangladesh now. And as we continue with that thought, I'm going to try to be a little bit practical tonight. And I just want to say that I have to admit to you, I had no vision for the country of Bangladesh. It was not on my radar. I heard of people going there. And I have no claim to anything great as far as some revelation that, yes, we should go to Bangladesh. This is simply how it happened. We had begun thinking that it's time for us. It's time to consider another opportunity for mission work or for reaching out. And just through some conversation that was mentioned to another brother, who later on came back and said, I thought about what you said, and here's an opportunity. You should think about it. That's all this was. Out of that discussion and out of that apparent opportunity, we decided to go look. And in looking, we found a need, an open door, and an invitation. Those three things. The country of Bangladesh, which I have drawn up here for you, it's not a very good map. You can see that quickly if you've seen it on the map. That's all right. But the country of Bangladesh is home to approximately 165 million people. To put that into perspective, that is about half the population of the United States. It's approximately five times the population of the country of Canada. And if you want a size of the country, it's 50,000 square miles, which puts it approximately half of the state of Oregon. The state of Washington has 70,000 square miles, so it's what does that make it? 5/7, 2/3, something like that, of the state of Washington. And of Canada, or we'll just use the province of Alberta, that made more sense to me. I could picture that. Alberta has 5 times the amount of land as Bangladesh has. So if we took Bangladesh, it would be 1/5 of the province of Alberta, but has 5 times the amount of people that the whole country of Canada has. And you can take it the other way. You can say it's half the population of the United States in half the state of Oregon. It'd be about the same. So you think it's crowded where you live. It's nothing like it is over there. You probably knew those things already. Now, one of the things that came to us, or that was represented to us, is that, and then I began to pay attention to it. I was not paying attention to it. I wonder how many people have heard of the Rohingya people group. Would you raise your hands? You know, I just find it repeatedly, thank you. I find it repeatedly that this is something we don't hear much about. It was in the news off and on, but it really has not been there steadily. And what it is basically is there is a people group who have a spoken language, not a written language, but they live down here in Myanmar, and they are predominantly Muslim. We did see a few Hindu Rohingya, but they're predominantly Muslim. They do not have citizenship in Myanmar or Burma. And because of some political events and because of some of the things that some of the radical Rohingya people did, radical Muslims, they did attack some of the border posts of the country of Myanmar. And the country of Myanmar, the military took vengeance on them in a way that seems awful to us, but is probably more common in those parts of the world than we realize. And they fled to Bangladesh. Now, this has somewhat been going on for years, but in the last year, they estimate somewhere between 600,000 and 800,000 people fled from Myanmar into Bangladesh. And the majority of that group of people is there's living in a number of small, not very large, but one large camp, and then a number of other smaller ones, that totals up to close to somewhere between 800,000 and 1 million people. Some of those had come earlier to the country of Bangladesh, but anyway, in that, just to give you a bit of a sense, so we're talking about 1 million people. The state of Washington has 6 million people. That's how many people live here in the state of Washington. Now, 1/6 of that in probably less than 10 miles square. Now, they're not all in one location. But a lot of people there, and these were a people. This was a closed state. Where they were in Burma or Myanmar was closed. People couldn't get to them, at least not easily. Now they're in Bangladesh. It's still not open to everybody, but it is open, more open than it was in Myanmar. And who knows what possibility there is there. Now, CAM is operating a medical clinic in the camp. And you maybe have heard about or recognized some names. Some of the nurses there, one is Bethany Burkholder, another that was there, I'm assuming she'll be going back, but she's not there right now, is Faith Ebersole, and a Ruby Miller. So 3 nurses there working, and there's a little clinic set up. And CAM had a reason for using medical aid, not food aid, and I don't know if I'm going to go into all of that, but their focus was on reaching people rather than just handing out foods or aid there. Now, in both the camp and in Bangladesh, there's a unique opportunity, I believe, a unique opportunity for conservative Anabaptists to share the gospel. There's a couple of reasons for that. With Muslim people, their perception of Christianity is violence, and Hollywood, immorality. That's what I think of Western civilization. I don't know if that's across the board. And we may argue with that. But I'm saying their perception of them is that. So, as Anabaptists, we have two things in particular that are different than what some other Christian people can offer. One of those is we believe in a practical expression of Jesus' love and in not going to war. And if you're confronted on the question of, what about the Crusades? You can honestly say that Jesus didn't teach that. And by practicing modesty and in upholding the principles of the New Testament in that, we also are saying that Christianity or following Jesus does not mean that you drop that. Now, further than that, even though Muslim people practice modesty, there are sadly a very great lack of right relationships between husband and wife. And the core, the inner heart of what God intends for us to have. And there is polygamy and things like that. And I'm not going to make blanket statements that there is no husbands and wives to get along. That's not my point here. But their view of women and their view of that relationship is not true to what God intended. I will say it that way. And so there's a unique opportunity for people and to challenge their worldview of what they expect and a chance there to share the gospel. In our trip, we went a number of places. So up here in Nazapur, in that area, there's a church that is established. There are believers. Between there and another village, there's about 70 believers, if I have my numbers right. Baptized believers. They have some leadership in place there. They're working with the pilgrim groups. You'll recognize the name Donald Eby and some of the others there. And they're teaching them. They're desiring to help them. But that church is growing on its own somewhat. And they do not have an ESL team there anymore. Now, they are maintaining an ESL team, English as a second language team, close to Charkali. I think it's in Shibakali. Did I say that right? And Shala. And seems like there's another place. Can you help me with that? Bajwa, thank you. I didn't put that on there. Our interest is down here in Cox's Bazaar, which is a different place than the others. That's where the Rohingya camp is, close to Cox's Bazaar, close to the village of Ukiya, actually. And that is also an opportunity there. I observed it is a populated area. It's not, and as far as Christian people, doesn't seem that much reached. You didn't see, not that I'm aware of. And it would be a wonderful opportunity to reach out to both the Bangladesh population and the people in the Rohingya camp. And that would be our goal or desire, is to start there. Now, in that, what we are really looking for right now, and what I'd really like you to think and pray about, pray the prayer that God would send forth laborers where He wants them. Now, you want to be specific. Would you pray and seek God's face in a family, house parents, for that medical work that Cam is doing? We have the idea that if we could get house parents there, we don't want just a warm body there. Yes, we want warm bodies there. But our goal would be that these people, especially the men, would have a vision and would be able to make contact so that we could teach English in the school in the village of Ukiya, which would be Bangladeshis. There may be a possibility of teaching English in the Rohingya camp. I don't know. We don't have answers to some of that. There may be other possibilities of work there. But especially that we could start something in the village of Ukiah. And so, really, we're looking for someone that has an interest in making contacts and pursuing avenues that would open the door to future projects there. I haven't talked much about the SALT program that CAM does. In the country of Bangladesh, that is a microfinance. It's helping them learn how to save money, small amounts of money. But embedded in the program is teaching and Christian teachers who can influence and show them the way to Christ. And it seems like in Nazapur that this is a powerful tool for people to come to know Jesus. The SALT program especially is very effective, where these men who were Muslims or were Hindus are going back to their own people, and they're taking them some understanding of how to save money, how to apply it practically in their village, but they're there primarily to show them Jesus. They were Muslims. They understand them. And they're there to tell them that. It happens perhaps slowly, and it happens in discreet ways at first. They have to have an open door to come in there. But it seems to be a powerful opportunity. So what we see is if we could put in house parents with the future goal of hopefully sometime an ESL team, and maybe that would open the door to SALT teams working in that area as a way of reaching people for Christ in hopes that a church could grow there. We would be doing things different than what we're used to doing. We would be fitting into the same pattern as what the Pilgrim Brothers have done. The acronym for their group is FLI. And they are not... The believers there do not look like North Americans. The ladies are wearing their veiling like they wear in that country. They're dressing like they do. But they are putting aside their jewelry. And you recognize they're dressed modestly. They're teaching them. There are aspects of that teaching that must be ongoing. There's different things that you run into. One thing that I think of is the usage of a day of rest. You see, a day of rest is absent in the Muslim culture. They take a little extra time on Friday to pray, but they don't have a day of rest. And Sunday is their first day back to work of the bank work week or the government work week. And those challenges, and they need some teaching along that line. But the brethren of the group that's there are teaching them, but they are not taking who we are and saying you need to look like us and do it exactly like us. Now, I think it's important for us, if we're going to follow that, to make a double cut. That is, if we're freeing them to be different than who we are, then we don't go there and try to be just like them. We go and be like who we are here. And we show them that we practice the same principles, and here is how we practice them. And I don't have all the answers to that, but I want to represent it fairly, and I want you to think and pray about that. I do know this, that if we're going to work in the country of Bangladesh, that's the way it needs to be. It's not going to work for us to try to do it radically different than it's being done. I don't think that's fair. And I don't think that legally it would work either. And so those are things for you to pray about and consider. Okay, I'm going to give you, in a moment, some time for questions as it relates to this. I will try to answer a few that have come to us. So the first opportunity for house parents is in the month of August. So to us it feels like do you understand that kind of language? We should be doing paperwork now, not asking for volunteers. But I do want to say that we don't want to get the cart before the horse. We want God to send workers. Also, the question comes sometimes, okay, are we looking for an older couple that doesn't have small children? Well, I don't think it has to be. There's some advantages to that, yes, but I don't think it has to be. And just to give a bit of a sense of expectation, if we fill this place, this house parents for the CAM work there, the nurses that are working there, they aren't going to need a lot of taking care of. They're really there as support, making sure meals are cooked. There's three of them. It's not a big unit. The place that they're staying, you know, really, I should promise you a lot of difficulty. And you should probably talk to Joelle about what it means to get sick in Bangladesh and some of those kinds of things. It's not going to be easy necessarily. I'm not trying to make it sound that way. But, you know, realistically, on the other side, the housing is not that bad. And it wouldn't be that hard for family to live there. If you're going in that time of year, you would need to do homeschooling. There are some things like that. And the man would need to spend time drinking tea and making contacts and relating to people in government and locally there. How long? I don't know if I have a good answer for that, but we're projecting that to start with, it would be wise not to say too long. Now, CAM is planning to have the base there, I don't know how long, but as there's need and as there's nurses, I think they'll maintain that base. And so we're just going to suggest, without making this too, okay, this is what we're planning, we're going to suggest starting out with 6 months or less for the first term of house parents. To start, it could be less than that, but that's a thought for starting. Okay. One more thing is there's also an opportunity for another house parent couple to go on one of the locations that the Pilgrim Brothers have. They're offering that we could supply a house parent for that to gain experience. And so there's also that opportunity. That would take place from January to March of 2019. So, I'll just conclude that part with this question. Is there someone here that God is planting a seed of interest in? I would suggest to you what we'd like you to do is talk to your local ministry. And we would love to hear from them or from you. But let's do it where you talk locally as a church. And then the recommendation comes that, yes, this brother or this family would be a good one for that job. That's what we'd like to see happen. Now, any questions? I've thrown a lot of stuff out there. Any questions? I'm not going to give you a lot of time, so you need to speak up quick. I think there are some people that could help with that. We don't have someone there as an interpreter. I think we would have to work out details as we go. So I don't really have a concrete answer for you. But probably not day in, day out, no. There are people that can speak English. English is taught in the schools. The pronunciation is hard to understand. And that's what's the teachers are teaching is they're teaching a spoken English, but it was a part of a British colony, and so English is a taught language. And for instance, when we stopped by the school in Ukiah, just poked our noses in as we're walking by, the teachers could, some of them could speak English and could communicate with you. It's not like you're totally without being able to communicate, although a lot without. Okay, any other questions? hot. In Bangladesh, when we were there, it was a pleasant time. Wintertime is a pleasant time. But I think, especially as you go south, down to Cox's Bazar, it is hotter. I will say that it's kind of a prettier place. Bangladesh is very flat. But down there, it's a little bit hilly, and in the distance into Myanmar, there's hills. It reminded me a little more of Belize, and just of southern Belize, not so much hummingbirds. And Cox's Bazar is actually the tourist destination in Bangladesh for Bangladeshis. It's not really foreign tourism. It's more for Bangladeshis. But it's along the coast there, and it is a nice place in a lot of ways. But that's not what we're selling tonight. Leave that part out. Okay, any other questions? All right, thank you for being so attentive tonight. I would like to conclude with this. Going back to the title that we had, Cast Your Nets on the Other Side. I want to reemphasize the important part tonight is to obey Jesus' words and to trust and rejoice in His miraculous provision in obedience. And what does that mean as it relates to this opportunity for the country of Bangladesh? What does it mean? Time will tell that. And I trust that God will continue to guide. And I hope that He will raise up those who He's calling for that work. May the Lord add a blessing.